Hey now, we are getting over, and I am the Silver King, Adam Silverstein, here to lead you through these hard times. Da-da. With episode 569, nice, of your favorite professional wrestling podcast. That's right, Getting Over is back once again, and it is Thursday, so you know exactly what that means. We are here to break down everything that happened over the last week in the worlds of NXT and AEW. NXT, of course, still building toward NXT Stand and Deliver on WrestleMania 40 weekend. AEW this week, we're giving you a bonus hour of coverage because they did air Rampage immediately after Dynamite. So instead of 5 hours of AEW, we'll be talking about 6 hours of AEW all on this episode. But I actually want to kick off this show with a special announcement, because for the first time in the history of the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast, we will be presenting you a two for Tuesday. That's right. This coming Tuesday on Getting Over, we're going to hit you with two episodes. The first coming in the morning as you're driving to work, waking up from your slumber, walking the dog, whatever the hell you do first thing in the morning, the Silver King will be sitting down one-on-one with none other than the man, Becky Lynch. You've been waiting for the interview to come to Getting Over. It is officially here. We will have that for you first thing on Tuesday. Longtime listeners know that I've interviewed Becky numerous times on prior podcasts and in my full-time job. But for Getting Over, it's a first time. We cannot wait to have the man on the show. And I promise you, it will be a newsworthy interview. And of course, later that day, we will have your normal WWE episode, your penultimate show before WrestleMania 40. But we're not talking about this coming Tuesday anymore. We're talking about this Thursday. And before we fully kick this podcast into gear, allow me to remind you that Getting Over
is all about Defy.
So be sure to head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a 5-star rating on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. It's also where you can send in questions and comments via DM or tweet for the show. And in general, just a place for you to interact with us. I saw there were about 200 of you who wanted us to do a March Madness bracket pool. We posted a poll on Twitter at Getting Overcast. For some reason, only 50 of you signed up. That's okay. It makes the chances of winning prizes even greater for those of you who are playing. And if you missed it, well, sucks to suck. Anyway, let's also remind you,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for $5 a month or 50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up. You will get bonus audio, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling, instant reactions to Raw, SmackDown, NXT, Dynamite every single week. You will also get exclusive news posts on Fridays. And we do have an interesting tidbit for you this coming Friday. Again, all of that, buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. All right, let's get into the meat of this show. We have a ton to talk about across NXT and AEW. And since we do have 6 hours of AEW to cover, we're going to save that for the latter portion of the show. We're going to start with NXT. As always, there are timestamps in the episode description. So if you want to listen to one brand or the other, you can skip around. But as always, I hope you listen to the entire show. So on NXT, Tatum Paxley fought Roxanne Perez. There were some pretty damn good social media promos from both of them before the show. Paxley attacked Roxy during her entrance, hit a few big moves early, but Perez threw her into the turnbuckles and she hit Pop Rocks and got the crossface in for a submission victory just over 5 minutes. Roxy immediately called on Ava to vacate Lyra Valkyria's title and award it to her. That led Lyra out to the ring. She had an arm brace. She was selling that arm. She got a few shots in on Perez. Roxy ran her into Tatum, ripped off her sling, locked in the crossface herself as Valkyria screamed in pain. Perez then stood over, holding the title, as one would do. Lyra later demanded Ava make the match for the title while holding her arm in the training room, and Roxy in the parking lot, even later in the show, talked about ripping the title out of Lyra's hands. So the action in this match, it was really strong, fast-paced, and while the quick finish made sense, because Roxy is a main eventer and Tatum is just nowhere near that right now, I was kind of disappointed it ended so fast. I could have watched them go for twice as long, if not beyond that. Tatum seems to have taken a really big step forward in the ring. The post-match was hot. Roxy leaning all the way heel, as she did last week, and showing a lot of newfound aggression and toughness. It's a perfect character change for her, coming at just the right time. The babyface stuff was starting to get stale. We talked about this a year ago with Bron Breakker, how badly he needed to turn heel. I think they waited until after Stand and Deliver to do it, but right here, it was the perfect time to turn her heel going into this match. And I still do believe that Shotzi was supposed to have the title and be involved here, but the fact that she's not, we do have a pretty hot program between Roxy and Tatum, second only really on the entire show right now to Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams, and that's something that's been built for multiple months at this point. The booking at Stand and Deliver, it's going to be curious. Is the injury to Lyra there to excuse her loss? Might that come with Tatum trying to help her? I don't see a reason she should walk out of Philadelphia with the championship. She's had a nice title run ever since she beat Becky Lynch for it, but strapping up Perez as a heel, it makes so much sense. She's doing a great job, and I think the title would only help elevate her even further. Metaphor was commiserating backstage with Noam Dar excited to beat up Trick Williams and Lash Legend, saying that she couldn't wait to get her hands on him, innuendo and all. But suddenly, she corrected herself and she was talking about kicking his ass. Suddenly, Alpha Academy sans Chad Gable came up. Otis started flirting with Lash literally while Maxine was on his arm. And I'm like, dude, do you not see what you already have here? I mean, Lash, beautiful woman and all, but you got Maxine right there already. Don't get greedy, man.
That's the most action I've had all year.
Maxine made it clear that they were there for other business. Metaphor, they were fun as usual. Hopefully this is a decent stay for the Academy down there. Maxine obviously needs it from an in-ring standpoint. We talked about that like 2 weeks ago on the WWE episode. But putting them in NXT, it clears the way for Gable to get serious for an extended period of time. And he does need to do that if he's going to go on a true singles run in WWE and hopefully at the end of that become champion. More on the Academy later. Trick backstage talked some shit to Dar and told Carmelo Hayes through the camera he'll whip his ass if he gets involved in their match. So we had Trick Williams, Noam Dar. Early in the match, we saw Melo's security knock on his door saying it's time. Trick hit a pop-up uppercut and a bookend. Lash jumped on the apron calling Trick over only to attempt a slap. He caught her arm with Dar hitting a German suplex and a spinning back elbow, all for a false finish. Williams eventually caught Dar blind with the trick shot, which is the name of his running pump knee finisher, for the win. I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. It's a totally fine move. He executes it well, but a guy with his size, strength, and athleticism, he should have a much better finisher than a pump knee. Dar's foot was technically under the bottom rope, and it really should not have counted, but it was not part of the story, so they did count the 1-2-3 here. Noam also should have had better in-ring presence to fix that. It was on him, referee too, but on him. He should have brought his leg in. It was kind of stupid. The match was solid, nothing special. Trick called Melo out after the bell. Security came out, all those security guys, and they went Shield style on the ring apron. Then we saw a guy who was clearly not Melo. I mean, just a way darker, like, skin complexion. He entered with a hood over his face. Melo revealed himself as one of the security behind Trick's back. And you could see his tattoo the entire time because he didn't wear a long sleeve shirt. So it was clearly Melo. And the other guy was clearly not Melo. Trick apparently so exhausted from the match, he didn't realize it. So Melo beat on him. The other three guys held his arms. And he eventually hit a pump knee of his own, Melo did, and screamed in Trick's face as NXT went off the air. There's something about this that, look, I don't want to say it's not working for me. It's just nowhere near as hot as it should be. And I do think the ratings for NXT are reflecting that right now. It was another rough week. The demo was pretty solid at 0.18, but I think the viewership was in the high 500s. And I mean, that's way under. It's like 200,000 viewers a night under what NXT had been doing at the start of the year. And it's because the product in many ways, and this storyline is the lead storyline of the show right now, it feels kind of cold. It's almost like it's being treated as a regular feud for a regular event instead of the culmination of a multi-year story and really multi-month story of them turning on each other, or Melo turning on Trick, between two former best friends. They should be at each other's throats. We should be getting heated promos and internal conflict and frustration. Instead, Trick was randomly embroiled in a two-week storyline with Metaphor and Lash. Melo's doing this gimmick with the security guards that makes him look like a total chicken shit heel. This is a confident dude. It's okay to, you know, give him some of those elements and play into the heelness of the entire thing. But he's running away from stuff. He's only getting beatings when that happens. He's not cutting promos. Where's the excitement? Like, when am I going to get juiced up about this? Next week, we're getting Prime Target. That should up the ante, but that also means they're not going to be on the show. And frequently, the two guys in the main event or in the big match are not on the NXT Go Home show. Maybe they'll already be in Philadelphia, you know, doing TV or doing media is what I should say. But I'm going to be immensely curious to see what happens on the Go Home NXT. I feel like this angle still needs a lot of juice. And again, if next week's going to be Prime Target, they need to hit a home run on that Go Home show in 2 weeks. D'Angelo family made a grand entrance to that new theme, which came across much better this time, but it still lacks the same oomph as the original. Tony D put over the wisdom of Luca Crucifino that he brings to the table, all that wisdom, saying, "With Tony's great power comes great responsibility." Dude, I guess, is Spider-Man all of a sudden. Then he expressed respect for Ilya Dragunov as a person and a professional, but promised to be the man who breaks the unbreakable. Ilya interrupted on the Titantron, saying the NXT Championship is beyond Tony's reach. He announced that Dragunov was booked against Stax next week and told Ilya not to make a wrong move or else he'd get buried. Most important here, again, for an NXT title match I really don't care about, is that D'Angelo has moved past the babyface or even the tweener role, and he's now clearly on the heel side. I would like to see him be a bit more heelish, like actually beat the shit out of Dragunov in a 3-on-1 attack. Maybe we'll get that next week. At least he and the family are aligned properly, and that's a huge positive. I'd call this a solid stage-setting segment. I just don't buy into Tony D as a legitimate title contender, especially not against someone like Dragunov, given the length of his reign and the success of his reign. Again, Tony was elevated in a random number one contendership a couple weeks or a couple nights after losing the tag team titles with no singles resume whatsoever coming into the situation. I understand that like Mello and Trick is probably going to main event Stand and Deliver, and therefore the main NXT title match does not need to be the biggest deal because it's not going to be the main event of the show. But I still find it hard to believe, I've said this a couple weeks ago and maybe last week as well, that Tony D'Angelo with no build was the best option when they easily could have just brought up someone from the main roster to take that spot. Hell, they could have brought in Ludwig Kaiser and had him do it, and it would have been hotter than what it is with Tony D'Angelo. So this was just a big mistake, and I don't know that it's going to be rectified by the time Stand and Deliver rolls around. Josh Briggs interrupted a transitional segment, cutting a promo on Obafemi, not just beating Brooks Jensen, but basically playing with his food. So he dared him to go face-to-face. Femi came out now with smaller braids, saying all he cares about in the ring is results. Briggs said everyone is confident until someone bigger and badder steps to them, which, like, fair enough, but Oba is way bigger than Briggs is. He stated his new gimmick, Man of Mayhem, and challenged for the title. So just as it seemed like Oba was accepting that match, Dijak came out, reminding that he claimed next. Briggs called him a wannabe Shaft. And Dijak, he had the line of the week in any wrestling company. He stuck out his hand and he said, "I don't know if you can see, but I'm white." And I laughed my ass off there. There was quickly a three-way brawl and it got separated by referees. So let's just start with this. Oh my meat.
There's a lot of beef out here.
I mean, if these guys do a triple threat, big meaty men slapping meat match at Stand and Deliver, that's going to be fan freaking tastic.
Big meaty men slapping meat.
That's what I want to see, and that's what they better give us at this point. Now, obviously, this was the expected match given last week's booking, and it's smartly put together because Dijak's experience is going to help Femi massively here. And I know Briggs seems new to many, but he's got 8 years of experience. He was wrestling in Evolve way before he went over to NXT when Evolve shut down. So it's going to be real interesting to see this mix of talent and experience. Dijak, he's been kicking ass on NXT for the last year plus. Briggs has immense upside. We already know that the ceiling is the roof for Femi. Interested to see how this works out. My only real issue in this segment was Dijak suggesting that Samuel L. Jackson is Shaft, which, look, okay, technically, he did play Shaft in a remake, but Shaft is Richard Roundtree, and someone Dijak's age should sure as hell know that.
Come on, Oos. It's a joke, right? It's a joke, Oos. You ribbing me?
Brooks Jensen stormed out of the WWE Performance Center angry as Fallon Henley followed him. trying to make sure he was okay. He was angry that Henley and Briggs have everything figured out while he's struggling and has no idea what to do next. Kalani Jordan then came up furious about the attack last week, and Fallon decided to get her back. And this was just a well-done parking lot segment, tied a few things together, nothing too special. Nathan Frazier and Axiom fought Charlie Dempsey and Miles Bourne in a qualifier to get into the qualifier for the Tag Team Championship number one contendership. Axiom and Dempsey chopped the hell out of each other. Frazier hit a perfect running moonsault on a hot tag, but got caught flying for a power slam and a ragdoll slam by Bourne. But Axiom caught Bourne with an avalanche Spanish fly, and Frazier followed with a Phoenix splash as Axiom eliminated Dempsey with golden ratio for the 1-2-3. This was an absolute fire match. These guys are basically the replacement for MSK without a team gimmick. You could put them, I said this about MSK, you could put these guys on the main roster tomorrow. Crowds would be absolutely thrilled watching them. I'm not saying they're main roster ready. I'm saying work rate wise, their main roster ready. Bourne showed significant progress in this match. Dempsey was fantastic as usual. This was just a total blast from start to finish. I'm at 3.75 stars B+ for this. If you like fast paced wrestling, this is for you. Hank and Tank fought the Good Brothers in the other qualifier. There was a lot of slow moving meat and shit in this match. The faces did a pounce up backdrop and a double shoulder tackle. Hank got taken out into the steel steps, with Tank taking a spinebuster and magic killer for the expected result. Nice talk and shop reference by Vic Joseph also in the finish here. It's clear Luke Gallows and Carl Anderson are ultimately going to win this triple threat next week. But really, they are the least exciting potential challengers for the Wolfdogs at Stand and Deliver, and even less exciting as potential winners, especially given the other options now are LWO and Frazier and Axiom. Maybe we get surprised or something, but you know, again, it's positive that they're putting main roster talent down in NXT, but they are really giving NXT the lowest level, you know, main roster talent. This is not Dolph Ziggler. This is not Becky Lynch, obviously, who was down there and had that great run at the end of 2023. You know, they're not putting people on this show that are going to move the needle whatsoever. No offense to the Good Brothers. Carl Anderson, G1 finalist. You know, Luke Gallows, legitimate long-term veteran who's had great matches in his career. Not these days, right? It's going to be interesting to see if this can actually work out and if it winds up being a good match at Stand and Deliver. The Wolfdogs argued backstage about Baron Corbin paying for dinner the night before. The Academy came up asking why they aren't in the Eliminator tournament. Maybe because you guys just got there. I don't know. The champions pointed out that they have nothing to do with the booking, so Maxine challenged them next week, suggesting that Academy get straight up added to the title match, making it a triple threat if they beat them next week. So while I noted earlier that I'm glad Academy is in NXT, throwing them right into a title match, if they get a happenstance victory next week, that would be super frustrating. You have to imagine this was just a book a match. Wolfdogs are going to get the win and we'll just move forward from there. Thea Hale ran up to Riley Osborne backstage, apologizing for being a weirdo on their date and hoping they can still be friends. Riley was just happy she's back to normal, and the rest of Chase U was pleased that she handled it that way. JC Jane and Jasmine Nix were nowhere in sight. It was legitimately good to see Chase U back to normal, and the extended storyline, it was nice for a change, but now they're doing what they used to do best, and that's refreshing. We had Drew Gulak against Osborne in a Heritage Cup match. Round one was excellent, with even wrestling both ways and Gulak helping Osborne just look fantastic. Riley had a perfect shooting star press and got a surprise 1-2-3 to take the 1-0 advantage. Osborne looked set to get another pin in round two, but Gulak did something I haven't seen before. He caught him in a leapfrog and hit a seated pinning combination. That evened it up 1-1. Then he delivered a cheap shot after the bell, and he kept in the Gulak in after round three when Osborne refused to tap out. So two cheating moves. JC and Jasmine made their way down during commercial break. Round four was also a blast. Hot action both ways. Hale crawled through the ring to chase Jane. That distracted the referee. It led to Nix grabbing Osborne's leg while he was on the top rope, so Gulak could just fall on top of him for the 1-2-3 and to retain the Heritage Cup for No Quarter Catch Crew. This was great all the way through. It was one of my favorite, at least, Heritage Cup matches since the trophy moved to the United States. Gulak and Osborne, they worked really well together. You got to believe Gulak has been one of his trainers probably for a while in the performance center. And the storytelling elements just across the board, they worked. It established the No Quarter Catch Crew's methodology for winning. It also advanced the storyline with Chase U. I went 3.5 stars here, and I normally wouldn't point it out, but some Heritage Cup matches are kind of dull. This one was not. It was pretty damn fun. Later backstage, Ava made a match between Nix and Hale. Thea was obviously thrilled about that and ran out of her office. Then she stopped Duke Hudson, Ava did, and told him that she was planning some type of number one contendership deal for the North American Championship, and he could get involved next week, and obviously he was pleased as well. Then we saw JC Jasmine, Kiana James, and Izzy Dame all talking shit about Thea, Kalani, and Fallon. The latter two attacked Kiana and Izzy basically after the other two heels left. The Hudson part here was confusing because it seemed pretty clear that we're just going to get a triple threat for the title. But we learned it's going to be Briggs against Hudson and Dijak against Spears in qualifying matches. And that is just massively convoluted. First of all, you're pretty much predetermining it's going to be a triple threat. And then you're putting two qualifying matches in to lead to that. But those matches are only in place because Dijak and Briggs already challenged for the title. So it's almost like the matches are happening to make sure they're worthy, as opposed for to being like a number one contendership type of situation. So that's weird. We already know the winners. I don't get why you would book it this way. Just save that segment until after they have those matches. Book both of those matches and then have them say, look, we just won. We just beat these people. I deserve a chance. I deserve a chance. And then you do the same segment. It was backwards to me is what I'm trying to say. Sol Ruka had her return match against Brinley Reese. Malik Blade and Idris Onofe were out with Reese. She did some decent work for a Neophyte, but this was really about featuring Ruka. She had a new surfer-inspired style gear. She had a really smooth soul snatcher for the win. Haven't seen her in so long. I forgot that was her finisher. It's such an excellent move. Blair Davenport attacked Soul from behind while she was celebrating and straight up flattened her with a Kamigoye. She had new like red eye makeup, much more colorful gear. It was definitely an improved look for Davenport. Not even a question. Gigi Dolan and Ren Sinclair were chatting about the low blows in last week's match when Ariana Grace popped in saying she was thankful the referee only caught the person who actually was trying to cheat, that being Gigi. She said she was excited about making Dolan a lady and gave her a Ms. NXT in training sash. Good start to this, already a fun dynamic. We will see. Sean Spears backstage was enjoying the show, happy to see people suffer. When he left the room, Joe Gacy climbed out from underneath a table, laughing manically, agreeing with him. Ridge Holland also cut a promo on Instagram saying he needs to be honest with himself and do what everyone wants him to do. Really not much to either of these. Lola Vice and Carmen Petrovic also did social media promos, showing off their legitimate fighting skills. Lola was wearing like the skimpiest outfit, just kicking the shit out of a standing bag. But that's her gimmick. Just kind of curious to see this all transpire next week. And you know what? Just for good measure.
It'll look good, but she's got me saying, hey now!
And last, NXT Anonymous caught Mr. Stone and Von Wagner getting in a verbal argument over Wagner carrying Stone backstage like a baby after he got his ass kicked by Alexis King last week. Stone's contention was it made him look bad by treating him that way. And it did. Made him look like a baby, but Von Wagner's huge, and he's not a wrestler, so I don't really see why that's a huge problem. Anyway, that was NXT this week. We do have, you know, some time until Stand and Deliver, but let's go ahead and take a look at the card as it stands right now. We have Trick Williams against Carmelo Hayes, the expected main event of the show. The NXT Championship, Ilya Dragunov against Tony D'Angelo. You heard my thoughts on that earlier. The Women's Championship, Lyra Valkyria against Roxanne Perez. I do believe this is the second best built match on the card, and it really should co-main event right before Trick and Melo. Tag Team Championships, the Wolf Dogs against a team to be announced, maybe more than one, most likely going to be the Good Brothers. And then the North American Championship, Oba Femi, again against, you know, competitors to be determined, most likely Josh Briggs and Dijak. So, you know, if you're asking, hey, Silver King, how excited are you about this card? I would say far less excited than I have been at most NXT cards for premium live events, but especially the WrestleMania weekend NXT cards. It feels like it's just missing something that is really going to get people to buy in, buy tickets, want to watch it. Even in terms of match quality, like, I'm not going to be surprised if four of these matches are really good. But at the same time, I don't know that any of them are actually going to be great. Maybe Trick and Melo will be. And usually when you go into a big NXT show, there is that one match that you know is either sneakily or definitely going to deliver. Maybe Dragunov and D'Angelo surprise me. As you know, I've been negative about it, but it's possible the Silver King is wrong, even though it doesn't happen that frequently. Let's go ahead and move over to AEW, where, as I mentioned, we have 6 hours of programming to discuss. But we actually have some additional topics before we get into what happened across Dynamite, Rampage times two, and Collision. So there was some terrible news coming out of Dynamite last week, and that is that Darby Allin actually broke his foot in that match with Jay White that was supposed to write him off so he could go climb Mount Everest. I'm not going to go back into my issues with that match the way it was booked, but it's obviously shitty for Darby that he had this grand plan to climb Mount Everest only for it to get thwarted at the last minute, completely unscheduled. The x-ray is gnarly. It looked like he broke 3 metatarsals, the big bones like under your toes that are on the top of your foot. Wish him a speedy recovery. The small, small silver lining is there's an actual ready-to-move angle with White upon returning, not just in kayfabe, but in reality as well. So that's going to be super hot when Darby heals up and gets back. I did want to discuss something else on this topic, though. And that's people out there grossly overstating and exaggerating the danger of climbing Mount Everest. And I'm not talking about on TV where they're kind of kayfabing it. I'm talking about fans and those who cover wrestling. Let me be crystal clear before I even start down this path, okay? I would never, ever, as Chris Jericho would say, ever in my entire life climb a mountain, let alone that one. It's scary. You're putting your life at risk generally. And I don't have it in me to do either of those things unnecessarily. So this is not made for the Silver King. But people are acting like Darby was committing himself to death by just climbing Mount Everest. The folks who die on Everest generally, and I looked it up to make sure that what I was about to say isn't bullshit, they're generally not 31-year-old trained risk takers with camera crews, probably significant financial backing, maybe even from Tony Khan, to get whatever top-tier equipment they could possibly need. It's a 1% chance in total for foreigners, like 300 people ever. That's a lower percentage than if you get into a car accident, just for context. So again, I repeat, I would never, ever do it. It's so gutsy that Darby was going to try and certainly will try in the future. I give him so much credit. I give anyone so much credit for risking their life and doing it. But let's not act like he was going to walk into the line of a firing squad or something. That's all I'm trying to say. He was going to climb a mountain, take as many precautions as he possibly could. There's inherent risks with that. But it wasn't like a death sentence is pretty much what I'm trying to explain here. And a lot of people were treating it like it was. Or that the chances were at least greater than 1%, which they're not. So beyond that, AEW still has some presentation elements these days that are unique to it. But while I was watching the Dynamite broadcast on Wednesday, I just could not help but think about how WWE-ized it is. Like LED lights everywhere, especially around the barricade. That's really the one that's off-putting to me. The title graphics sliding on screen before championship matches. The way they do graphics for promos and even people walking to the ring. Moving to white ropes instead of black. The chrome steel steps. The commentary table ringside when it used to be on the stage. The huge massive screen is the primary part of the stage. Super bright lights everywhere. It's like that guy Mike Mansouri joined the company and just repeated the old WWE playbook as if they're trying to fool the audience into thinking it's the same product. Meanwhile, WWE just recently has actually changed a couple things. They're darkening the barricade and some of the lights around the ring, but obviously they still have tons of LEDs and lights. One of the cool things about AEW for so long was how different it looked and felt when I tuned into the broadcast. Now, look, it did have to modernize. Don't get me wrong. Some of these things I mentioned are positive improvements, but doing all of them together almost makes it look like a different version of a WWE product as opposed to something different and unique. Like NXT looks more different from the WWE main roster than AEW does. And they're a totally different company. All they had to do was something like keep the ramp going to the ring, keep the announcers on the stage, don't do the LED barricades. Like just a couple changes would allow it to look different and set itself apart again. But even the way the shows are getting constructed, especially Dynamite, the similarities are obvious. There's multiple ultra-long promo segments, especially to start shows, trying to force fans into doing chants. Some segments are seeming far more scripted than they ever were before. And it's a stark contrast when you get a segment like you got with Mercedes Moné to open the show this week. The AEW title segment is another example. And then you get like the Will Ospreay segment and the Kazuchika Okada Eddie Kingston match. Having variety is great. But if I want to watch WWE, I'm going to watch Raw or SmackDown, not another company trying to be WWE, because guess what? WWE does WWE better. You know, it's just something that stood out to me Wednesday night. And I think I may have even seen that, like, Dave Meltzer said something similar. Anyone who listens to the show, you know, I don't agree with him on much. And I don't know exactly what he said in this regard because I didn't listen or read to what his comments were. But the feeling was obvious watching Dynamite on Wednesday. And if you didn't notice it, then I don't know that you were paying attention close enough, because even more than it had been when some of these changes were being instituted, this past Wednesday, when the entire thing came together, it was just like, I'm kind of watching a WWE show here. It's not to say the wrestling wasn't better. It's not to say other elements of the show weren't different or better in many cases. It's just the feeling overall that I had while I was watching the product. Now, moving into the match breakdown that we've been doing of late, 60% of matches this week had storylines and logical builds and or logical builds. That's the best mark that AEW has reached, I think, since we started tracking this. And it's pretty close to what I think we said was an ideal percentage, like 66, 70%. That said, I do need to point out that 4 hours of Rampage and Collision, only 20% of those matches fit the bill. And that's giving credit in both cases for the open challenge on Dynamite and the tournament matches, none of which have storylines, but they do have legitimate builds circumstantially based on what types of matches those were. Point being, Dynamite completely carried the water once again. Collision simply needs to be booked better. It has to be feeling like it's a part of the product, not a 2-hour show of matches announced a couple days in advance. And look, this is not a difficult formula. Paul Heyman has shared it before, so I'm utilizing something that he said previously, but it's all blatantly obvious to anyone who watches wrestling. Who is fighting and why should I care about them? Why are they fighting each other? Why should I care enough about them fighting each other to spend my time and or money to watch it? And in AEW right now, most of the time, not all of the time, but much of the time, I should say, the answers are they're wrestlers. You should care because they're good wrestlers and you should watch it because AEW is putting on real wrestling. Those are not good enough reasons for most people. Sometimes, sure, I just want to see an exceptional wrestling match. I tuned into Will Ospreay versus Michael Oku because I heard it was a great match and I watched it and it was a great match. I'm still catching up. We'll get to those like 8 matches that I said I'd watch to start 2024 at some point. Once we get past the Masters in April, late April, we'll go through all of that. But I don't care about most matches for the sake of them being matches, or most titles for the sake of them being titles. We want Cody Rhodes and Chad Gable and Drew McIntyre, and for AEW, Swerve Strickland. We want them to win because of their stories, not just because they're good wrestlers. And that's something that needs to be applied to a lot larger percentage of the AEW product. So with that, let's go ahead and break down Dynamite, Collision, and like I said, a double dose of Rampage. On last week's Rampage, the TBS title was on the line. Julia Hart, this is a paradigm of what I'm talking about. She retained over Trish Adora in 8 minutes. Adora got this title match despite being winless in 13 AEW matches since 2021. She had also lost 6 straight Ring of Honor matches since the year began. That's ridiculous. What happened to that ranking system that was brought back like a month ago? Is that just gone now? Julia won with a moonsault. But again, this is exactly what I'm talking about. On Dynamite, Mercedes Moné opened the show with Tony Schiavone calling her, quote, one of the biggest stars in the entire world. Okay, Tony. By the way, here's another thing. Why is Tony Schiavone still wearing a maroon jacket in 2024 when it doesn't match any of AEW's colors? And it's not a modern color jacket by any means. It's not something that's trendy. He would look eons better in black or gray or something like that. But I digress. He didn't even ask her a question. The crowd reaction here was interesting. It was maybe half as loud as Big Business, if that. She threw to a video like they do in WWE, another example of that. It showed clips of her in New Japan and doing some of her movie premiere red carpet walks and such. Mercedes said she's not there to lead an evolution. She's done that already. She's there to lead a women's global revolution. She didn't know Julia Hart's name and stumbled in multiple parts of her promo before doing her sign-off. The lights went out and came back on. Julia standing on the ramp, Sky Blue immediately ate a backstabber, trying to attack Monet before saving Julia from the Monet Maker. So they grabbed chairs. Chris Statlander and Willow Nightingale made the save with chairs. The lights went out. They were gone. But the camera messed up. They kept the camera ringside and showed the apron moving after Sky and Julia had crawled underneath it. Then Willow was holding a chair behind Mercedes' back in the most unconvincing manner. Monet turned around and yelled at her. She dropped it and the segment ended. This whole segment was an absolute mess. Huge regression from a presence and promo standpoint just 1 week after Mercedes' debut. There's also a disconnect between the way she says her name, Monet, and the way everyone else says it, Monet. They got to figure out which one it is. Monet is what she wants it to be because it sounds like money. Monet is the way it's spelled. I'm fine with her kicking off an AEW run with the Willow feud. I know some people have a problem with it. And if that's where it's headed, it just makes sense because that's who she was injured against. It doesn't make as much sense that they're both baby faces and Willow's the one that they're trying to make into a heel, if either of them, for this. Maybe that can get worked around. I was probably more praiseworthy of Mercedes last week than others were, but nothing about this week was exciting or intriguing. Between the messiness of the promo, the beyond kayfabe hyperbole, and those real forced CEO chants, which I told you guys last week, those are going to get old quick. 7 days later, they're already old. On this week's Rampage, Willow and Stat fought Hart and Blue in a street fight. The faces got a quick promo backstage. Mercedes walked up after they stopped speaking with Stokely Hathaway standing between them, staring at her with a shit-eating grin on his face. Monet and Stat shook hands. Then she dissed Willow because of what happened earlier and dipped out, leaving Stoke hanging. I really enjoyed the way this was shot in the backstage area. It was a different venue from like a visual standpoint of what they normally do backstage, and it just allowed the entire segment to stand out as something different than normal. Now, entrances ended with 7 minutes left in the show, and apparently there was an overrun, but I had no idea, and I was fine with that. It was just weird that the match started so late with the overrun just kind of being assumed by everyone. I appreciated that both teams had matching gear, especially the faces, who were dressed for a street fight. Julia took offense with her body wrapped inside of a chair. Stat dodged Julia, who stabbed Sky in the head with a big nail that House of Black always uses. Then it went to commercial with 3 minutes left in the show. Stat put Julia through a table with an air raid crash during Picture in Picture. Willow took Code Blue on the announce table. This was a great spot. Julia took 3 shots into the steps. Awful spot just because of the camera angle. 2 bags of thumbtacks came out with 2 tables set up ringside. Stat was powerbombed into the tacks. Sky then fed her some and super kicked her. Willow took Sky out with a Death Valley driver through 2 tables. Julia dodged a 450 while on a stack of chairs and then locked in Heartless, making Stat tap out to end the match, which was just a massive surprise given how strong you would think Stat should be booked. Now, it was a risk putting this in the same 3-hour block as the I Quit match, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but this was different enough where it did not feel repetitive. Thumbtacks, they are used so frequently in AEW, they don't really feel special anymore. But that's really my only criticism of the match. They sold the big moves. They didn't rush spots. All 4 women got individual moments where they were able to shine. And it was super entertaining. I was exhausted staying up for this 3rd hour, and I was really regretting it. But this match made me pleased I watched Rampage. I just hope AEW never does this 3-hour block again, because it was straight up exhausting. And I'm not sure why I feel that way when I do it for Raw every Monday, but maybe it's because I'm used to it on Raw and I'm not used to it for AEW. And maybe it's because AEW is just a different type of content. But like I said, it was exhausting. I went 3.75 stars B+ for this match. I thought it was super, super entertaining. On Rampage, Konosuke Takeshita beat Commander in 10 minutes. There was a great powerbomb counter into a Code Red by Commander. Then he hit a springboard Canadian Destroyer, which was also sick. Takeshita got boots up on the tightrope Shooting Star Press, hitting a powerbomb and a messy spinning Falcon Arrow for the win. It was a fun TV match. You know, it was all about individual moves. There wasn't really flow or story to it. And again, it was booked for no reason. But again, it was also fun. On Dynamite, Swerve Strickland was interviewed backstage, reminding that he's still after the AEW title, especially after Samoa Joe choked him out. Swerve said he wanted to fight and issued a real open challenge where he's going to wait in the ring for an opponent, hopefully someone big. Imagine that. A real open challenge in AEW. Amazing. He's fully leaning into this random chain gimmick, which has kind of popped out of nowhere. On Dynamite, later, Swerve had that open challenge. Butcher answered, which was disappointing, but at least realistic. Swerve dominated him and hit Swerve Stomp. Then he tried a new submission finisher where he put his fist on the interior of Butcher's elbow and bent it like in its normal direction. It was really slow to engage. It looked awful. Swerve has got to think of a better submission finisher than this. Swerve then cut a promo, a second promo, I guess, on the night, saying he went from respecting to not liking to almost hating Joe. He said he'd beat up people by the week until Joe gives him a title match. So Joe entered in a suit. He decided to give him what he wants to prove to the fans that they can't accomplish what they set their minds to. Don Callis then randomly entered, saying Takeshka has the same win record as Swerve, except he's undefeated. The fans booed the ever-loving shit out of Callis, and I loved it. It was the loudest reaction, babyface or heel, the entire night, back to like the real heat that Callis used to get consistently. Awesome. Swerve decided to take that challenge and then fight Joe after. The graphic was again ready 5 seconds later. That is just ridiculous. Happened like three different times on Dynamite. Now, to be fair, Callis made a legitimate point, but this was like the second time in the last few weeks where Joe basically decided to let Swerve fight for the title, only for them to get distracted by someone else. In this case, it should have been stated by Joe or Tony Khan through Schiavone that Swerve versus Takeshka is a number one contendership match. Even Callis, I don't believe he directly stated that Takeshka deserved a title match. He was just saying, you want a title match. Meanwhile, my guy has as many wins as you do, and he hasn't been beaten. Now, these are major creative flaws as far as I'm concerned. Either that or they're execution flaws from the wrestlers cutting the promos. They got to tighten shit like this up, either by clearly stating it's a number one contendership or not having Joe accept the challenge, only to then seconds later change the trajectory of the storyline. The match was nothing. Swerve's promo was really rough. Joe and Callis were the stars of this segment. On this week's Rampage, Takeshka beat Rocky Romero. Takeshka hit one of those seated tombstones plus a blue thunder bomb for a false finish. Then he hit the spinning Falcon Arrow for the win. This was a good wrestling match. It just really wasn't worth breaking down further. Interesting that they're moving away from the blue thunder bomb and moving towards the Falcon Arrow, seemingly for no reason. Blue Thunderbomb like was his finisher, and I think it still should be, but the Falcon Arrow looks good as well. So either way, it's totally fine. On Collision, Adam Copeland closed the show with a promo segment where he talked about the friendship with Christian Cage, overcoming obstacles, having tons of success together, and now being at odds because of Christian's ego. Then he unveiled Spike from that really odd gray box, the weapon that scared Christian. It's a 2x4 with dozens of nails sticking out of the top. Certainly something that could hurt if it was real, but nothing like this should have garnered the kind of reaction it did from Christian a week ago, simply because it was laying in the box and he saw it. It was a passionate promo from Copeland, brought back a lot of the intensity that was lost from last week's ridiculousness, and it was smart to close Collision with something other than a heatless match for a change. Also on Collision, Daniel Garcia beat Lee Moriarty in 5 minutes with a heel hook submission. It was a really rough match. So the main event of Dynamite was the TNT Championship, Cage defending against Copeland in an I Quit match. After Copeland entered, the crowd continued singing the Metalingus theme. It was awesome to hear. He had blue and white Toronto gear. The fans chanted holy shit before the bell rang. Cope took a Bruins jersey off one planted fan, then a Maple Leafs jersey off another, put them on Cage and himself respectively. And then they did a hockey fight in the penalty box like 1 minute into the match. They set up a ladder between commentary and the barricade with Cope slamming Cage's back into it. Cope took a header into some steps, then bladed. Christian splashed off the top rope outside through a table that was leaning against the barricade. Really cool, but also dangerous spot. They bumped shoulders on a double spear. Cope brought out a hockey goal and threw Cage into it. Christian looked like he was going to quit, so Shayna Wayne ran down and gave Cope a hockey stick low blow. Did you guys know, by the way, that Canadians love hockey? Just wasn't sure if you realized that. Christian bashed Cope with the hockey stick and then jammed it into his throat, and he basically passed out and therefore could not say I quit. So the match continued. Christian grabbed a barbed wire wrapped steel chair, but Cope dodged a concerto with it. Cope came back using the stick for a crossface. Then he removed it because you can't say I quit when you have something that big in your mouth. That's what she said. And choked him with the string from his tights. The patriarchy broke the attempt and Shayna slapped him. So Matt Menard and Daniel Garcia made the save. Cope impaled Luchasaurus on the chair. Then he climbed a ladder to splash the heels that were not competing at ringside. The faces handcuffed them to the corners. So Shayna ran away. Copeland speared Christian and then handcuffed him the same way. Then brought out Spike, low blowed Christian 9 times, hit him in the crotch with Spike, and then threatened to hit him in the head with it, and he got the I quit for the win. You would think that you would take that shot to the head and then quit if someone's going to hit you in the nether regions with it. I mean, I would, but I digress. This was simultaneously a great match and a total clusterfuck. And it's a shame because it was running really hot for the vast majority of it. I mean, it was exceptional work between these guys for like 20 minutes. And then it just became an absolute overbooked mess. Copeland, a babyface, won his first title in AEW with the help of two mid-card at best guys. And he only won because of handcuffs, 10 low blows, and a weapon that was the center of a two-week storyline, but was only brought out for 2 minutes. Shayna got more offense than her son did. I think she got more offense than Luchasaurus did. The positive of the booking is that Christian's character is such an absolute piece of shit that he deserved every single thing he got. I'd probably have been more positive about this if, let's say, it was Garcia beating him, just because he's not an established dude. So doing all this stuff to beat Christian would have made a lot more sense for him. Copeland really shouldn't have needed all of it, right? And Christian, you could argue, came out looking stronger than Copeland, given he took that much punishment and still refused to quit. Let me repeat, though. I was entertained by like 90% of this. It was just the last 10% that put me off. And because of that, I can't decide which side I'm on. B plus, A minus, I'm right there. Kind of like an 89, 90 out of 100. That's kind of where I sit. It was a very entertaining match. If you haven't seen it, I would definitely watch it. Just be prepared for what you're going to get in the finish. On Collision, Pac beat Aaron Solo by knocking him out. After a black arrow, he had put the submission in and he just passed out. Then he told Tony Khan through a promo that he was looking for trouble and would find it himself. Great. On Dynamite, the Continental Championship was on the line. Eddie Kingston defending against Kazuchika Okada. There was a backstage bit with the Young Bucks bragging about learning Japanese and promising to be Okada's personal match producers. Renee Paquette turned into a sideline reporter, giving thoughts on a Kingston interview that we didn't see as he was walking down to the ring for the match. I really enjoyed that. I think they should save it for title matches like this, or at least really deep feuds. Don't do it too much, but when you do it, it's a unique touch to the presentation. The crowd was super hot. Cameras cut away from the match early to show the Bucks producing alongside Tony. Kingston caught Okada off a missed high-risk move with the back fist, but it was a delayed cover. Okada briefly gouged the eyes, but the referee chose not to DQ him. He ducked a back fist and hit a spinning power slam, and then he hit Rainmaker for the 1-2-3 to win the Continental title and officially break up the fake Triple Crown, whatever you want to call it. Tons of pyro after the bell. That can be explained by the Elite Association. Though they didn't say that, it would have been nice if they explained, hey, you know, we normally don't give pyro after title wins like this, but clearly the Elite paid for it. Pac then walked out on stage and left. It was never explained why Okada challenged for only the Continental title, nor why the trio of championships were split, neither by the wrestlers nor by commentary. The match was okay, real predictable bell to bell. Actually had much higher expectations than what was delivered, just given the talent of both guys. I'm not going to grade it, but like if I did, it would be a low B, B minus, something like that. Okada immediately capturing gold, that was ultimately the right decision, just given his stature. And as I mentioned last week, I'm glad Rainmaker is getting protected as a finisher. One shot, one kill, what's the deal? None of the 25 Rainmaker bullshit like you get in New Japan. Two other notes. I never particularly thought anything about the design of the Continental title, but seeing Okada carrying it, damn, is it ugly. It really needs to be redesigned. It's rough. And two, Okada is now the quickest rise wrestler to gold in AEW history. 14 days between his full-time debut and winning a title, which is pretty cool. Brett Malam at Brett_Malam, he wrote in, obviously, they're probably trying to get their money's worth, but how do you feel about Okada wrestling fairly regularly on free TV as opposed to being more of a special attraction wrestler? You know, I know there's people out there who have been decently critical about Okada's start with AEW. I don't have much of a problem with anything they've done. We may know Okada through New Japan, but while most AEW fans are likely aware of him to a degree, there's surely a lot of people watching that product who only know him either from clips online or Forbidden Door matches, not his entire New Japan catalog. And you need to be able to get the crowd familiar with him as quick as possible. Now, I mentioned earlier how ridiculous it was that like Mercedes Moné got that video package because A, it didn't show any of what made her famous, which was WWE. And B, she's so established, everyone knows her, that you don't need a package to explain her. Okada really could have used some big 4-5 minute, maybe not that long, 2-3 minute video package, just going through all of his success in New Japan, showing highlights of his biggest matches, beating Kenny Omega, losing to Kenny Omega, fighting Will Ospreay, all of these things. He's the type of guy where they could have said, hey, the Young Bucks, they spent money, they sunk it into production, and we're introducing you to the new greatest wrestler in AEW, not necessarily the leader of the Elite, but the linchpin of the Elite, Kazuchika Okada. That's what they really should have done at some point. But in lieu of that, they decided to give him a couple matches to get the crowd familiar with him, and it worked. Plus, there's a reason that he had those matches. He was winning a title, and they needed exposure first. There's plenty of time for Okada one day to turn into a final boss type of character. It's fair to say now is not that time, but perhaps it should be soon. On Collision, Bryan Danielson fought Katsuyori Shibata. Now, before we even get into this match, it is absolutely without question a dream match. Let's make that clear. And while arguments have been made by others that it being a dream match means it requires no further storytelling, I point out that actually building to this match, such as what AEW is doing with Bryan Danielson and Will Ospreay, would have made it even more epic than just 3 days before saying, oh, by the way, you're getting Danielson and Shibata on Collision. Why simply announce a match like this on short notice and have it start out a show with nary a video package? Not even one on Rampage, which was a day before leading into it. Promos maybe from the guys explaining why the showdown means so much to them. We really couldn't have taken 45 to 60 seconds per guy and had them explain why they want to fight the other person before you do the entrances to start Collision. There's no excuse for that. So while I'm about to praise this as a wrestling match, the idea that it was perfectly acceptable for this to have no storyline, no build, no development, no promotion, for me, that's absolute bullshit. Danielson took a vertical suplex over the ropes outside before Shibata battered his chest and neck with chops and forearms. Then Shibata hit a Death Valley driver, but Danielson came back with a Bezaiku knee for a false finish. So then he went to a label lock. They got into this controversial sequence that other people had a problem with, where they traded chest kicks, running boots, and ultimately sat cross-leg knees to knees, trading chops and slaps. I personally had no issue with it. I've watched plenty of New Japan, and this was clearly a strong style match. I did think that Danielson no-sold a little bit too much during the sequence, especially compared to Shibata. He sold all the strikes better, and it also would have been nicer if it was short, but it was extended, and that's, I think, why people had such a problem with it. But they followed with a series of pinning combination reversals, ending in a crucifix 1-2-3 for Danielson. It was excellent bell-to-bell, Shibata's best work since returning. Bryan made sure Shibata got his flowers after the match. That was really nice. I'm at 4.25 stars and an A. Certainly no higher than that. That's the ceiling, but it was the match of the week in AEW. Danielson cut a promo cross-leg backstage after the match with massive bruises on his chest, but especially his shoulder. He talked about Ospreay saying it's cool if he followed and emulated him, but he hasn't walked in his or Shibata's shoes because they were told they couldn't wrestle again, yet came back and are doing great. Basically, Danielson's point was he's willing to go further than Ospreay, and he didn't think he would ever, you know, match him in that way. Strong as usual from Bryan. On Dynamite, Ospreay opened hour two to a huge ovation. He said he's changed as a person and is now focused on the betterment of AEW by bringing in elite wrestling. Fans chanted bruv. Ospreay put over the Danielson Shibata match and retaliated to the shoes comment by saying they were too small for him. He really just completely missed the point of what Danielson was saying. He's like, you haven't faced adversity like we have. Not that we're so good and you can't match how good we are. So that was a little rough. He put over his own New Japan career. Then he challenged Shibata, saying he's a different man at 30 than when Shibata beat him 7 years ago at 23. There was a graphic on screen 5 seconds after he made the challenge. Such a freaking eye roll. But this was another fantastic high-energy promo from Ospreay. He's kicking ass on the mic so far. He's still looking to the left randomly, and it might be a better idea to just give this guy a mic and let him move around the ring. Let him expel some of that energy and play to the crowd. It felt like he was cutting a promo in a box because he kept having to return to the corner and speak into the microphone being held by Shivani. But the Ospreay promos, despite that, are 2-for-2. The Shibata match next week is a must-see. Not sure how much more material they have for the Danielson build. Maybe they take a week or two off. I believe Dynasty is still 5 weeks away. I really only have one question when it pertains to Ospreay at this point. What happened with the Don Callis family? His first two nights as a full-time AEW wrestler were spent fighting Konosuke Takeshita and Kyle Fletcher in a storyline with Callis. They didn't attack each other. He beat both of them. He never said he was leaving the family. They were all fine. They're heels. He's a face. Is the whole thing just straight up dropped? If they go back to it after Dynasty, why weren't they involved with him across the other 2 months, given they're all still on TV? It's just kind of strange. On Rampage this week, Shibata squashed a jobber in 2 minutes in a completely worthless match. He's fighting Ospreay next week, as mentioned. Why not have him get a win over, I don't know, an actual legitimate AEW talent? Let him beat one of the Canadians there. Matt Menard was there. Let him fight. Have it go 7 minutes. What's the harm in that? I don't get it. On Rampage, there was a vignette for The Righteous that was about a whole bunch of nothing. They dug some type of package out of the ground. Now, I figured this was to remind fans that they exist because they were going to be in the tag team tournament. Nope, it was not. It was for this. On Collision, there was a match, Claudio Castagnoli against Lance Archer. Righteous interfered after 11 minutes for a disqualification as Claudio was attempting the swing. Danielson saved 1-on-3 and ate a cutter, so Shibata ran down with a chair to clear the ring. Clearly, Jon Moxley must be out injured because he's been absent for multiple weeks now. We know Archer and Righteous have been paired recently without explanation. I'm confused why this is becoming a storyline with BCC, but okay, like, it's decent. My bigger issue is this was another disqualification on AEW. And again, they don't do it so frequently that it's been an issue historically in the company, but this is like the third or fourth disqualification in a month. And that is a lot for AEW. When they do them, it needs to have a reason and make sense. There was no reason Claudio could not have just beat Lance Archer, and they do the exact same thing given how frequently Lance Archer loses to everyone. On Rampage, Tony Storm and Mariah May beat Kayla Sparks and LMK. Who? Exactly. In 3 minutes, Tony hit Storm Zero and let Mariah get the cover and some spotlight. I'm not sure if it was ever explained why Storm went from ignoring her existence to suddenly caring about her. It's just because she dressed like her? I'm not being facetious. I really don't remember. As they were celebrating after, Deonna Purrazzo and Thunder Rosa ran down to chase them out of the ring. Chris Jericho acted like Rosa had just returned. She's been back for weeks. Deonna said that she would see them next week. Then on Collision, Deonna and Thunder were interviewed. Purrazzo said they've never teamed before, but they have mutual respect from fighting one another. Rosa said they were going to stop all their games, and their mission was TV time. Did I hear that right? That's their mission? The pairing makes sense because of their hatred for Storm. I just wish there was a bit more storytelling of them like discussing with each other why they were aligning versus simply saying, hey, we fought before, we respect one another. It's still a semi-improvement. They at least gave us something. On Dynamite, Purrazzo and Rosa fought Storm and May. Deonna was pissed that Thunder blind tagged. She took out Mariah but ate a hip attack for Tony. Suddenly, as Storm pulled her out of the corner, Rosa just hopped over her with a jackknife cover and got the win. Real curious decision to have her pin Tony clean like that. One presumes maybe that's going to be the women's title match at Dynasty. Maybe Purrazzo gets upset, turns heel. But this was a short match that was real strangely paced. Not much at all to write home about. It was, I'm trying to think if it was the worst match of the show. No, it was the second worst match of the show. This was the worst match of the show. FTW Championship on the line, Hook defending against Chris Jericho. Hook hit a T-bone suplex seconds after the bell with Jericho selling a neck and or head injury. That was clearly kayfabe because no one even bothered to check on him, including the trainer who they've had check on people who get head and neck injuries in kayfabe. No realism whatsoever here. He took 7 more suplexes, all of which were slow as molasses. Jericho hit a lion salt, then totally botched a toss suplex with Hook landing on his face. That could have been really bad. Hook then kind of climbed on Jericho for red rum in the ropes, but Jericho straight up broke it on the canvas. Then Hook grabbed him and rolled him over for a trap 1-2-3. They dapped up after the bell. Jericho backstage called Hook a future world champion and said he had a proposition for him next week. The general concept of what they did was fine. Jericho putting over Hook. The match was awful. Jericho gets hit in the head a dozen times and loses via schoolboy. Such a downer. And it was a real hot start to the show. And then this came on. Real boring. Somewhat predictable in terms of the way it transpired. Jericho needs to just take a break from TV and he come back with something captivating where he's in more of a storytelling role with less wrestling. Maybe he's about to offer to be Hook's manager. That could work. In terms of Hook being a future world champion, I mean, if he is, something has gone seriously wrong.
Get a life, kid.
On Collision, Kyle O'Reilly beat Brian Keith in 11 minutes in his return match, basically after 2 years out of wrestling. O'Reilly hit a rebound lariat and brainbuster before winning with an Armageddon armbar submission. Keith tapped out like 5 seconds into the move. Good match, good reception for Kyle. Undisputed Kingdom came out after to celebrate with him, and Kingdom put O'Reilly on their shoulders. Now, I thought they're going to backdrop him because he decided not to align with them a week ago. They just put him down. So not that exciting. On Rampage last week, Undisputed Kingdom beat Top Flight and Action Andretti in the main event. Roderick Strong got the fall with End of Heartache. On Dynamite, Adam Cole did another promo from his upholstered chair, yelling that he was disappointed in Wardlow for losing to Samoa Joe, saying he, meaning Cole, but actually Wardlow, should be AEW champion. Cole said Wardlow's new goal is to ensure everyone else retains their titles, and if he does, maybe they will forgive him. Cole said he wants Wardlow to reach his true potential and warned him not to screw it up. Why is he telling an AEW camera this? Shouldn't he have been saying this to Wardlow directly? Strong promo from Cole as usual, just in terms of delivery. Curious to see how Wardlow receives it. Why should he even remain with Undisputed Kingdom at this point? No one helped him in his match. He shouldn't give a shit about anyone else. They were only tied together due to their hatred of MJF. They already cost him the title. So he has no reason to remain with this group. On Rampage this week, Bang Bang Gang cut a promo from a pool making fun of Darby Allin for getting injured. Juice Robinson was not so hidden, walking in the background. Jay White said he saved Darby's life and painted what was supposedly Sting's back gold. They also talked about taking the titles off the Acclaimed, who entered for a promo in the segment that followed. Max Caster was angry about the attack and said White was scared of them. Okay. Their promo was so dead in the water that Anthony Bowens made a WWE reference saying, maybe White should have listened to the online fans and signed somewhere else. And the fans didn't even react to it. You know, they normally mention WWE or take a shot and they go, boo, or oh, or something. They didn't even give a shit. They turned the scissors into middle fingers and the segment ended. Bowens was better than Caster, clearly, but my Lord, this was twice, maybe three times as long as it needed to be, and just extremely poor from start to finish. I sat there just waiting and begging for it to be over. Acclaimed, they've been completely run into the ground, totally overexposed. The trio's titles have become worthless. It is just super rough from top to bottom with them.
I hate this. I hate this crap. Stop. Stop with the crap.
On Rampage, Orange Cassidy and Trent Beretta beat Dark Order in 10 minutes with Trent hitting Strong Zero. We'll move to the AEW Tag Team Title Tournament. On Rampage, the Infantry beat House of Black. Yes, I said that. Sean Dean took Dante's Inferno from Brody King for a broken fall. The other dude took a Death Valley driver into the announce table and then a pile driver into it by King. Buddy Matthews stomped Dean inside and pulled him up before the three count. Julia whispered to Buddy and the referee got distracted. Mark Briscoe ran out, threw a chair at Buddy while he was on the ropes, then got chased through the crowd by Brody. Everyone on House of Black seemingly forgetting this was a wild card qualifier for a title tournament, and Dean draped an arm for the 1-2-3 in 8 minutes. Malakai Black then stormed down and stared into the crowd. This was atrocious. And beyond the terrible match, how the hell did Top Flight and Private Party automatically qualify for the main tournament? But House of Black, former Trios champions that had a nice run with the title, why did they have a wild card match against the Infantry, which we just saw for the first time last week?
Off is the direction you can fuck.
On Rampage this week, Orange and Trent fought Powerhouse Hobbs and Fletcher. There was a lot of nice offense here. Fletcher's mouth got completely busted open. He hit Cassidy with a spinning tombstone. Trent did an avalanche half and half suplex that looked dangerous. Orange hit a tornado DDT and Orange punch and got the win as Trent speared Powerhouse Hobbs. This was a fun match, a perfect tournament match. The winner being obvious was okay, but it stands to wonder, like, is Don Callis' family, are they ever going to be successful at anything? At this point, I just don't think they're going to be. On Rampage last week, Saraya screamed backstage that her brother wanted a fight. Then her brother started rabidly screaming and semi-attacking two guys like he was an animal. Then Angelo Parker showed up to actually fight him. They got pulled off by security. It was horrendous. Then on Collision, Zach accepted the challenge in another yelling promo, but he refused to do it in Canada for an unknown reason. We also saw Parker screaming that he was ready to fight, and Ruby Soho told him to relax. He was ready to go fight Zach anyway, but she said she wouldn't be by his side if he did. Why? Like, this is their profession. The dude got cheap shotted, and he wants to fight the dude. So she won't be by his side if he does that? This is completely awful.
That is one big pile of shit.
On Rampage, Serena Deeb got a tape promo that was the same as every single one she's cut upon her return. And also on Rampage, speaking of random, there is a Queen Aminata video package that was completely about a Ring of Honor storyline. Why the hell was that on Rampage? She wasn't bad, but it made no sense for it to be on the show. So, folks, that wraps up AEW this week. As noted, there was a lot of good to great this week. And I have immensely enjoyed Dynamite for the most part over the last, I want to say, month, maybe month plus. But Collision and Rampage, they are just impossible to get through. I figured out a way to get through Rampage without, you know, actually wanting to, you know, poke my eyes out. Collision is usually more entertaining, but they got to give us reasons to watch these shows. Both of them were under 400,000 viewers this week. I mean, that is horrendous for Collision. I don't care that it's on Saturday night. It's still on at 8 p.m. People will watch wrestling at that time. They watch WWE premium live events. They watch AEW pay-per-views at that time. And this thing is getting, I forgot the exact number, but like 380,000 viewers with the same demo as Rampage, which is airing Friday nights at 10. You cannot have that happen. Now, as we tape this show, you know, I don't have the Dynamite rating for this week. And you guys know we normally don't talk about ratings for really any shows unless they're notable. Collision was notable this week. NXT was notable this week. Last week was notable with AEW simply due to Mercedes Moné, and the number was way lower than we expected it was going to be. I don't have what it is this week, so I don't have any further analysis for you. But I would be surprised if this show was suddenly way up compared to last week when it was her debut and a highly promoted card. But again, that said, this week you had Edge and Christian in a main event in an I Quit match. That's really attractive to the casual viewer. You would hope so, at least. And like I said, it was actually the main event of the show as opposed to Mercedes last week, which opened the show. So maybe it carries a little bit better. Perhaps it's something that we talk about next week. But all in all, Dynamite, thumbs up. Everything else, for the most part, thumbs down, with the exception, of course, of Bryan Danielson and Katsuyori Shibata. So folks, that wraps up this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast. As mentioned, we have a special Two for Tuesday coming for you. This week, the Silver King sits down one-on-one with the man, Becky Lynch, Tuesday morning. You're going to want to listen to that episode as soon as you possibly can. Then Tuesday afternoon, we'll be back with our next WWE episode. And 1 week from now, same bat time, same bat channel, we'll be talking NXT and AEW again. On the way out, allow me to remind you that the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast
is on! About Defy.
So head over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a 5-star rating on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. You can also send us tweets and DMs, questions, comments. We will read on the show. Please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well. For $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up. You will get bonus audio, instant reactions, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown, plus exclusive news posts every single week. Plus, if you sign up, you're directly supporting the continuation of Getting Over. Again, buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Thank you all so much for listening to this edition of the program. As mentioned, we will be back for 3 shows next week, including that Two for Tuesday, Becky Lynch sitting down with the Silver King right here on Getting Over. But it is officially time for me to sign off and time for me to leave you with just 3 final words. Bye for now.